From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Inner Sunset.
Outer Sunset.
North Beach.
Mill Valley.
Knob Hill.
Berkeley, California.
Berkeley.
Albany.
Alameda.
The Presidio.
Coming up, Bay Area Jews head to the desert to reclaim their biblical roots.
Really, I caught fire. And all of a sudden, I had to learn the ancient traditions. I had to learn the ancient language. I had to begin to understand, like, what our ancestors had passed down to me.
Then we'll talk with an urban explorer about how he finds wild nature amongst us in the city.
She was seeing these things because she had these fresh, childlike eyes, and I was completely blind to them because I was just seeing tree. To see this thing that had been invisible emerge was just magic.
We're learning from wilderness today on Cross Currents. We're in the midst of Passover week when Jewish families all over the world sit down to seders. Passover is an ancient tradition that brings up a modern question. Are American Jews having an identity crisis? That's what a recent Pew Research study seemed to show. It found more people who, though born Jewish, don't identify with the religion. What the Pew report didn't capture is a reverse trend. Innovative organizations are popping up all over the country. Jewish after-school programs, Jewish farms, Jewish LGBTQ and environmental groups, all building bridges between ancient and contemporary cultures. We're looking at that today as part of our series, The Spiritual Edge, stories at the intersection of innovation and belief.
I'm a Muslim.
I am a Jewish.
I have no religion.
I'm Christian.
Reform Judaism.
I'm Catholic.
Muslim.
Not religious.
Buddhist.
Southern Baptist.
Hindu. Atheist.
Christian.
Agnostic.
Catholic.
KALW's Judy Silber was intrigued by the idea of exploring her own Jewish heritage in a more modern way. She followed a Berkeley-based organization into the desert to watch them bring Judaism's ancient teachings to life.
I'm Jewish. I feel a strong affinity for Judaism, the beauty of its rituals, teachings, and music, and it can be hard to relate. The Old Testament has a demanding God and strange customs, like animal sacrifices. And then there's Jewish law called halakha with its crazy complicated rules about how to run your life, what foods you can or cannot eat, what clothes you can or cannot wear, and how you observe the holidays. This past spring, I tagged along with Wilderness Torah, one group that's trying to bring new meaning to the old tradition. Passover is one of the most important holidays on the Jewish calendar. Traditionally, you tell the story of the Israelites' liberation from slavery in Egypt over an elaborate family meal. Wilderness Torah takes the story to the desert.
Hey, welcome, you're here, you made it. Out of Egypt, ready for some liberation?
Woo. About 150 people are gathering in a remote spot called Panamint Valley, 8 hours south of the Bay Area. As we arrive, a warm wind swirls dust in our faces. A friendly woman in her 30s dabs our foreheads with a wet cloth.
It is hot, like really hot.
The desert feels big and suffocating. I think of the Israelites and the Passover story. In Egypt, they were slaves. With the help of God, Moses, and a few miracles, they escaped, crossing the Red Sea into the desert. Then they got scared and wanted to turn back.
This song is to inform you of some hazards that exist on this land.
Rattlesnakes, black widows, spiders, and scorpions.
Rattlesnakes, spiders, and scorpions. It's easy to see why they wanted to go back.
So really, Wilderness Torah is a project of remembering.
Zelig Golden is the founding director of Wilderness Torah.
It's a project of remembering something very, very ancient about being an ancient indigenous people while contextualizing that for our modern time.
A decade ago, Golden was an environmental lawyer. Like many American Jewish kids, after his bar mitzvah, he became less involved with Judaism. But then at 30, something changed.
I caught fire. And all of a sudden, I had to learn the ancient traditions. I had to learn the ancient language. I had to begin to understand, like, what our ancestors had passed down to me.
Golden was also interested in Native American traditions. He went on a 3-day vision quest in 2007. There, he says, he heard a message. reconnect your people to the natural world. Not too long after, he organized the first Wilderness Torah festival.
Within the sacred text are embedded powerful lessons about how to relate to each other, how to relate to the earth, and how to walk in a sacred manner on this planet.
All around us in the desert are signs that this is a uniquely Jewish experience, like the kosher food and Hebrew words tossed casually into conversation. Or that big sound, which comes from an ancient instrument called a shofar, made from the long, curved horn of a ram. Dinner in the desert is held in a large, open-air tent decorated with colorful tapestries. As we eat, I look around. The people here are a smorgasbord of Jews, people who grew up Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, or nothing at all. Some go to synagogue or keep kosher, and some don't. Wilderness Torah attracts a lot of young people in their 20s and 30s, earthy hippie types. But there are others in their 40s and 50s and families drawn to the special programming for teenagers and kids. I talked to the Yusim family, originally from Ukraine, now living in San Jose. Andy Yusim is 8 years old. Can you tell me about your connection to Judaism? Do you feel Jewish?
I don't know what it means.
You don't know what it means to be Jewish?
I know what it means to be Jewish, but I don't know what Judaism means.
Like many ethnic groups, the strands of Jewish culture are growing weaker through the generations. Andy's mom, Irene, says that's why they're in the desert. She wants her children to know their heritage.
You know, I don't want them to grow up and say, Mom, you didn't tell me I was Jewish. You didn't tell me, you know, we have traditions and holidays. So I'm doing what I can. I don't know a whole lot myself, but I want them to know that this is what it is, and there are all kinds of people who celebrate it in all kinds of ways.
Throughout the festival, I ask people about their relationship to Judaism. Many tell me they feel connected, but they also struggle.
I don't really know how to define my relationship to Judaism.
I wrestle with ideas of God.
A lot of the people in my family didn't believe in God, but they said, you must follow religion, but there was no meaning to it for me, and I found that hard.
You know, reading the text in synagogue, yeah, it didn't really have, like, a lot of connection to my daily life.
I do not like the patriarchal aggression that happens towards the repression of women.
The conflict also is, like, the other parts of you, you know, being American, being other interests, other passions.
So I sort of went, yeah, and left it all and married a Catholic and just went away. But I still felt I missed some sense of belonging that I needed.
Friday, my second day in the desert, I talk with Jacqueline Marks in the early morning.
It was wonderful waking up this morning. I slept really without a sleeping bag. It was so warm, and I woke up to the sun rising and to some music and a few people shuffling around, and it was very peaceful. So our tent is right next to this beautiful mountain range, and it's black and red and white, and it's a very unique spot to be camping.
In the afternoon, I meet someone with special insight on the significance of the desert in Jewish tradition.
I'm Ted Ryder, and I'm a rabbi.
Ryder is off duty now, a Jewish seeker in the desert just like the rest of us. I still ask for his wisdom. He says the desert is a raw and empty place where transformation is possible.
You know, Moses was out in the desert. Elijah was out in the desert. In the Christian tradition, Jesus was out in the desert for days and days. It was there that they found the answers to questions maybe they weren't even asking.
7 days is Shabbat, the Sabbath, the day of rest. Traditionally, people pray and study at the synagogue. We gather in the meeting tent. We sing songs and say Hebrew prayers and read from a Torah that survived the Holocaust, though its original owners did not. Its presence brings up what some people say they think about a lot. They feel responsible to ancestors who suffered or died for their faith. An irony is clear. Today, American Jews are free to practice without fear, perhaps more so than any other time in history. And yet, precisely because there is so much freedom, it requires a deliberate choice to stay involved. After the service, Wilderness Torah director Zelig Golden tells us each of us will go into the desert by ourselves. We will stake out an isolated spot and sit there for a few hours. We've talked a lot about the Passover story. Golden says it's now time to embody it.
There is some mystery here. You go out to be in the land by yourself, and you know, it might just be a nice walk in the sunshine, in the wind. And you know, it might be a lot more.
I walk northeast for a ways. Sitting by a creosote bush, I crumple desert dirt in my hands, pick up a rock, look up at the vast sky, and ponder the questions of my life. No ready answers come, but I feel joy. The desert is special. It's quiet.
So I'd love to hear from perhaps a few of you, just like a word or a phrase from what you brought back from your wilderness encounter. Anyone?
Just listen.
Be like the wind.
Call for what you want, even if you don't know who's listening.
Get down on the ground.
Stand on your head.
In celebration, the group sings and dances for hours. The late night moon is rising when I sit down with Jacqueline Marks again.
What I love about Wilderness Torah and these types of immersive retreats is they're full of so much song and music and prayer and teaching. And I think there's a lot of magic that happens here. I have not found such a deep spiritual connection to Judaism and to God in other places.
For this chant, we're gonna have a moment of silence in the chant, and during that beat, I want you to listen to the heartbeat of the earth. Shema Yisrael Adonai
Eloheinu Adonai Echad. In the morning, I will return to the Bay Area, happily connected to my heritage and ethnic birthright. It's a powerful feeling, knowing that among 7 billion people on the planet, you belong somewhere. For Cross Currents, I'm Judy Silber.
That story first aired in 2014. Wilderness Torah's next visit to the desert starts this Thursday. Find out more at kalw.org and click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. While San Francisco can't compete with the Panamint Valley Desert for isolation or for wilderness, you'll find the city is teeming with nature if you just take a moment to look. From slugs to oaks to falcons, we share our sidewalks with a variety of life. That's what author Nathaniel Johnson found in his new book, Unseen City: The Majesty of Pigeons, the Discreet Charm of Snails, and Other Wonders of the Urban Wilderness. He sat down to talk with KALW's Ben Trefney and began by reading a passage from Unseen City.
I started thinking about pigeons only once I had been shit upon. This, I would learn, is a common initiation, a baptism of sorts, into pigeon research. I found one writer after another who reported having begun paying attention to the birds after a presumably learned, scholarly pigeon anointed them from above. The pigeon that elected me was an Argentine pigeon. I was spending a few months in Buenos Aires, where pigeons are everywhere. Another thing they have everywhere in Buenos Aires is a type of cookie, the alfajor, made with the whitest of flours and dulce de leche, which is basically caramel cubed. I ate one with chocolate dulce de leche one evening as I was hurrying to my friend's apartment for dinner. I was brushing the last crumbs off my fingers as I trotted down the subway stairs. It was dusk, so I didn't see the white and brown globule on my sweater until I walked under the subway lights. It was about the size of a fingernail. A cookie crumb, right? Oh no, Nate. No, not right. Without thinking, I scooped up what in reality was a pigeon turd and popped it into my mouth. I spent the next several minutes on the platform flinging my hands in the air, spitting into the tracks, turning indecisively in tight circles and silently screaming. The other writers waiting must have wondered what they were witnessing.
Yeah, that's disgusting.
Yeah. So, and after that, you know, when I would walk through pigeons and they would fly around me, I would just like flail spastically. And I really disliked pigeons for a while. And then I started doing some research on them and I got even more grossed out. But then along the way, I started to gain this respect for pigeons the more I paid close attention to them.
What inspired you to write this book overall, do you think? What sense?
Basically, I had a kid, and I was walking up the hill to drop my daughter off at daycare every morning. She would point to every freaking tree along the way and be like, "What's that?" And I'd be like, "That's a tree." And she'd be like, "What's that?" "Well, that's actually still the same tree." And it was
because she's like 2 years old.
She was about one and a half at this point, and just learning words and
Josephine.
Her name is Josephine, and just interacting. And it was driving me crazy. And so I made this little rule up where I could only answer the same way once. So I would say tree, but then I couldn't say tree again. I could say leaf, branch, twig. And then I had to look closer and I saw these flowers that I'd never seen before, these tiny little beautiful yellow flowers. And I, you know, I said flower. And that was this kind of magical moment because she was seeing these things because she had these fresh childlike eyes. And I was completely blind to them because I was just seeing tree, period. And so to see this thing that had been invisible emerge and become visible and beautiful to me was just magic. And so I wanted to share that with other people.
Mm-hmm. There's a quote that you have actually at the end of the book from Rachel Carson. It's her wish for children, where she says, "She wishes a sense of wonder so indestructible that it would last throughout life as an unfailing antidote against the boredom and disenchantments of later years." What do you think causes that disenchantment for people?
I think it's just growing up. I mean, we actually train ourselves to stop seeing things, right? Because every grown-up, every parent has had the experience of dragging their kid along the sidewalk and they will become fascinated with something.
Yeah, they move slowly.
Right. They completely forget where they're going. And if we did that, we wouldn't get anything done. We'd get lost at the bus stop looking at a spider's web or something and not go to work. And so it's actually this skill to blind ourselves so that we can remain focused on the things that help us pay the rent. But it's also a real loss if we can't turn that on again and see the richness and beauty in the world and just become purely focused on putting food in our mouths.
There's a part there where I could really see you as a dad where it's in the turkey vulture section where she says, "Let's be a turkey vulture family." And I mean, she gets up and she starts running around. And you start chasing her and making turkey vulture cries.
Swooping our wings, yeah, making these horrific turkey vulture cries.
What's that sound like?
It's sort of like a. And we were doing that. We just looked them up on the, you know, on like my iPhone or something and seeing what these things sounded like. And so we were trying to make those sounds and eating, you know, the dead carcasses all around our house. And it's a good time. The beauty of nature. Mm.
That's Nathaniel Johnson. He is the author of the new book, Unseen City, which is set right here in the Bay Area. One of the chapters that I was most fascinated by, I think, was about crows. Because there's a lot of crows where I live in San Francisco, and I don't know. I mean, there's something that seems somehow, at least in lore or something, more distinctive about other birds, you know, the songs and calls of other birds. But I became really fascinated by crows and what you had to write about them. What were some of the things that came up in your research on them?
Well, I got interested in crows because I was watching them chase after hawks. And this is something that you've probably seen, even if you haven't been aware of yourself seeing it. But, you know, two or three or four crows swooping and diving, and this hawk or falcon kind of ponderously flapping and trying to get away, and every once in a while trying to, you know, dive in and catch one of those crows, and the crows getting out of their way just in time. Crow researchers think that there may be something cultural here, that they're like showing off or, you know, committing acts of bravery. Or maybe it's like our version of big wave surfing, you know, that it's just this extreme sport.
The thrill.
The thrill, yeah. Or maybe it's, you know, they're like brushing back, you know, the hawk and showing them who's boss, you know, in some larger scheme of things.
Like Steph Curry against all the 7-footers.
Exactly, yeah.
And there was a researcher who said that he had banded these crows, put some bands around his legs so he could identify it, and it really pissed off the crow, and that crow seemed to hold a grudge against him, and then like let other crows know to hold a grudge against that guy too.
Yeah, they'll communicate that this is the evil leg banding guy, and they can communicate that to their neighbors and also to their offspring, and like generations upon generations of crows now have learned that this crow researcher, John Mardeliff, is someone to watch out for. And just the opposite, too. There's people who feed crows and make friends with them and develop these relationships, and you know, the word of that can spread as well.
Mm. Yeah, that intelligence was really surprising to me. And I guess that's one of the things about your book, is it does get into how these species tick.
Yeah.
And they're all around us, and to understand that better, you know, really makes the world a richer place. And that makes me wonder then. We talked about Rachel Carson's quote about the disenchantment of later years. So I'm wondering, what do you recommend people do, and what do you do now to re-enchant yourself?
So there's a couple really simple things that you can do. One is, I mean, the most simple thing that you can do is just take 1 minute even and look at something closely that you're walking by. You know, you sort of see a tree and walk by, and to just stop for 1 minute and stare at it until that presence of attention burns through the expectations you have for that thing, and you actually see what's in front of you. And if you do that, I guarantee it, you'll see something that you hadn't seen before. You know, you'll see some leaf gall that some insect has made to lay its eggs in, or you'll see some little flower that you haven't seen before, or something interesting with the bark. And you can do that with anything, with a spider web or a flower or what have you. Right now, it's all the flowers are coming out, and that kind of is a good entryway into this because they grab our attention. You know, we walk past pigeons every day, and we certainly know what a pigeon looks like. But I at least hadn't ever noticed the color of their eyes until I started looking closely, and it's really crazy. They have these shockingly bright, unusually colored eyes. And maybe I shouldn't say what they are so people can look closely at some point. But it's something that if you were seeing this in some like crazy tropical bird, you'd be like, that's amazing. Click, 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 taking pictures. But it's right under our nose, and we're blind to it.
That's Nathaniel Johnson speaking with KLW's Ben Trefney. Nate writes for the environmental magazine Grist and just published his book Unseen City: The Majesty of Pigeons, the Discreet Charm of Snails, and Other Wonders of the Urban Wilderness. And if you venture into the digital realm, make sure to stop by KALW.org and sign up for our podcasts. Besides Cross Currents, you can download Your Call, City Visions, and our brand new talk show, Kamau, right now. And it's all for free. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. So stay in touch. Our team includes Lisa Bartfai, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Truk Nguyen, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Jeremy Dalmas. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by ensemble Mik Na Wuj, an avant-garde hip-hop orchestra from Oakland. They'll be playing from their new album tomorrow night at the Chapel in San Francisco. Doors open at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. Cash rules everything around me, cream, get the money. Dollar bill, yo. Cash rules everything around me, cream, get the money. Dollar bill, yo. We can trace back to cash fiduciary conflict, every slug to the bonnet. War and conquest, pillage of populace for the orb and the continent. Bronze, iron, gold, platinum, oil, or diamonds. Wars of violence, the toil of tyrants, smiling at the sea.